And we'll take advantage of that break to read, as we always do at the top of the hour, today's birthday announcements. Only one of our listeners celebrating a birthday today, maybe suffering. Judith and I are both suffering today. Happy birthday to Beatrice Reynolds of Waterloo. Beatrice Reynolds of Waterloo, happy birthday to you. A couple of celebrity birthdays. Your comedian Carol Burnett turns 91. Hard to believe. Guitarist-songwriter Dwayne Eddy is 86. Drummer Roger Taylor of Duran Duran, 64. Actor-comedian Kevin James, 59. And actor Channing Tatum is 44 years old. If you are listening, you are listening to IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service, and if you're hearing us on your television on Iowa PBS and you're not a registered IRIS user, please give us a call, 515-243-6833, so we can get you on our birthday list. We need to know who's listening also in order to keep our services free. And now let's turn it back over to Judith to finish that story and take a look at obituaries.
We want to finish the story.
Oh, I thought you were going to finish the weather story, but were you done with it? Just go ahead on to obituaries.
Here's the rest of the weather story. What is Iowa's severe weather outlook for Saturday? It will be partly sunny in Des Moines on Saturday, with a high near 79 degrees, and showers and thunderstorms likely before 1 p.m. The nightly low will be near 60 degrees. Most of central and eastern Iowa are at a slight risk for severe weather. Primary threats are damaging winds and hail. NWS said heavy rain and some tornadoes are possible. And for Sunday, what is Iowa's severe weather outlook for Sunday? Sunday's high will be near 73 degrees in Des Moines, with a low around 60 degrees. The highest chance for strong to severe storms will be late afternoon to evening, and storms before Sunday will impact the details surrounding the day's risks. And I will move on to the obituaries for today. And there are three. Josetta Mulvihill of Cumming, 81, passed away April 22nd. She was a beloved mother and friend who will be deeply missed by all who knew her. Jo was born in Rock Island, Illinois, where she attended Sacred Heart Grade School, Alleman High School, and graduated from Mary Crest College in Davenport. During and after college, Jo spent 5 years in the convent of the Sisters of Humility of Mary. While in Des Moines, she met and married Bob Mulvihill of Cumming, Iowa, in 1969. Together, Jo and Bob farmed in the Cumming area until 1986. During that time, she had 6 children. Josetta is survived by her husband Bob, her children Robert, married to Renee, Jennifer, married to Tom Pasco, Brian, Sarah, married to Kevin Burgess, Daniel, married to Jenny Bynes, and Catherine, married to Eric Blackman. She has 15 grandchildren. She was an active member of the Federated Women's Club in Winterset. After raising her family, Jo worked for Polk County Social Services. Most of her time was spent with the Crisis and Advocacy Division, where she helped sexually abused women and men. She retired in 2009. From 2011 to 2020, Jo and Bob spent winters in Corpus Christi, Texas. Around that time, Jo was diagnosed with Alzheimer's. The family would like to express many thanks to all who provided care to Jo over the years. Visitation will be held from 3 to 6 p.m. on Sunday, April 28, at Caldwell Parish Funeral Home in Urbandale, with a rosary taking place at 5:30 p.m. Mass of Christian burial will take place at 10 a.m. Monday, April 29, at St. Patrick's Catholic Church in Cumming, with burial to follow. In lieu of flowers, memorial contributions can be donated to St. Patrick's Catholic Church and/or to Ruth Harbor Ministries, a ministry for unwed mothers. A live stream of the funeral service will be available at www.caldwellparish.com. And from Urbandale, John J. Chavas, Jr., 84, died on April 23rd. On Sunday, April 28, the family will receive condolences at Isles Dunn's Chapel, beginning at 1 p.m. A funeral service will be held at 2 p.m., followed by a graveside service and interment at Jewish Glendale Cemetery. John was a longtime resident of Des Moines and owned several businesses, Shavas Vending, Forest Avenue Laundry, and One Stop Laundry Shop. He also spent 16 years as a terminal manager for Consolidated Freightways. John was a longtime member of both Temple B'nai Shezeron and Tifereth Israel Synagogue, as well as serving on the board of Calvin Manor. He was preceded in death by his parents, his grandson, and nephew. John is survived by his wife, Joyce K. Shavas, a sister, Elizabeth Turner, daughters, Elizabeth Hoffman, married to Mike, Melissa Miller, married to Dave, and Nicole Schwegler, married to Paul. She had five grandchildren, six great-grandchildren, and four great-great-grandchildren, and one nephew. You may visit www.islescares.com to express condolences. And one final here. The Reverend Albert Bulow, age 29, from West Des Moines, died on April 23rd. Arrangements are at Isles Westover Chapel, April 30th at 11 a.m. And the service location will be April 30th at 11 a.m. at Messiah Lutheran Church. Interment will be in St. Paul Lutheran Cemetery.
And we'll move to page 6A of today's register. Witness talks catch-and-kill scheme in the Trump criminal trial, which, of course, is going on today in New York. Here's a summary in today's register of what happened yesterday. It's by the USA Today staff. David Pecker, the former chief executive of American Media Incorporated, the parent company of National Enquirer, testified yesterday that his editor-in-chief believed porn star Stormy Daniels' allegations of an affair with Donald Trump. As part of his testimony in Trump's New York criminal hush money trial about an alleged scheme to catch and kill stories that could embarrass Trump ahead of the 2016 presidential election, Pecker also testified that Trump described Karen McDougal, a Playboy model who alleged an affair with Trump, as a nice girl. Trump denies all the affair allegations. The former president faces 34 charges of falsifying business records to cover up hush money payments made by his former lawyer, Michael Cohen. Pecker testified about McDougal's story of having an affair with Trump and his communications with Trump and Cohen about it. McDougal has claimed they had an affair that overlapped with Melania Trump's pregnancy. Asked by prosecutor Joshua Steinglass why Pecker thought Trump should buy McDougal's story, Pecker testified he believed McDougal's story to be true, and he thought it would have been very embarrassing for Trump personally as well as for the Trump campaign. Pecker testified about a discussion with Michael Cohen, Trump's attorney, regarding who would ultimately pay $150,000 in hush money to McDougal. Cohen allegedly told Pecker not to worry, quote, the boss will take care of it. Pecker testified he understood that to mean he would be reimbursed either by the Trump Organization or by Donald Trump. Steinglass walked Pecker through a contract with McDougal where McDougal would also get a monthly column in two American Media Incorporated magazines in addition to the $150,000. But Pecker testified that after the purchase, he never planned to publish McDougal's story. Pecker said his main reason for buying the story was to prevent it from influencing the 2016 presidential election. Steinglass asked Pecker whether the hush money to McDougal was reported as a campaign finance contribution. Pecker said it was not. Pecker testified that after speaking with a lawyer, he decided not to pursue reimbursement of the $150,000 that AMI paid to acquire McDougal's story. The boss is going to be very angry, Cohen allegedly told Pecker. I can't believe it. I'm a lawyer. I'm your friend. This is all Cohen saying this, according to what Pecker testified yesterday. Cohen said, I don't understand why you're so concerned. Pecker said Trump called him and asked him if he had seen an interview between CNN journalist Anderson Cooper and Karen McDougal. Pecker confirmed that he had, and Trump said he thought there was an agreement that McDougal couldn't give interviews or be on television shows. Pecker said he amended it to allow her to speak to the press. Pecker testified, Mr. Trump got very aggravated. Trump couldn't understand why Pecker amended the agreement. Pecker told Trump that McDougal was flooded with press requests for interviews, so he amended the agreement, even though he also paid McDougal. Trump was very upset and couldn't understand why Pecker amended the agreement, Pecker testified. Pecker said that as part of a September 2018 non-prosecution agreement that AMI entered into with federal prosecutors, Pecker reviewed a statement of facts having to do with things that Pecker says the company did for Trump ahead of the 2016 election. The agreement required the company and its representatives to cooperate and give truthful testimony and information. In return, it would be protected from criminal prosecution for campaign finance violations. As part of that agreement, the company made several admissions, Pecker confirmed. After direct examination of Pecker concluded, Trump lawyer Emil Bove began his cross-examination. Responding to a question from Bove, Pecker confirmed that Cohen was always clear with him that he was Trump's personal lawyer and not working for Trump's campaign. This could be a key point the defense tries to make throughout the trial. Prosecutors have alleged Trump falsified business records concerning a $130,000 hush payment to porn star Stormy Daniels in order to unlawfully interfere in the 2016 presidential election. That alleged purpose is one of the key theories from prosecutors for why the charges are felonies. The defense may try to prove the hush money was for another purpose, such as shielding Trump's family from potentially embarrassing stories. Pecker also testified that he has met with prosecutors 4 or 5 times and that they have always told him to tell the truth to the best of his ability. After excusing the jurors, but before ending proceedings for the day, Judge Juan Merchan discussed a trial issue with lawyers that is tied to a question from Trump's attorney about whether Hope Hicks was at a 2015 meeting involving David Pecker. Hicks was Trump's presidential campaign communications director for the 2016 election and later served in Trump's White House. The judge said Trump attorney Bove misled the jury by asking Pecker if a document would refresh Pecker's recollection about the Hicks issue, and then presenting Pecker with a document that, according to the judge, did not contain something to refresh Pecker's recollection. The judge clarified he wasn't accusing Bove of deliberately misleading the jury, but he will still address the issue with jurors on Friday.
Arizona's fake 2020 electors indicted. This story by Stacy Barschinger of the Arizona Republic from Phoenix. A grand jury has charged 11 Arizona Republicans and 7 top aides to Donald Trump in a scheme to keep Trump in the White House by falsely certifying he won the state in 2020, though voters in the Grand Canyon state narrowly favored Joe Biden. Attorney General Chris Mays, a Democrat, announced on Wednesday the grand jury had issued the 9-count indictment. It alleges the slate of Republicans, sometimes known as fake electors, and the Trump aides engaged in a conspiracy aimed at preventing the lawful transfer of the presidency of the United States, keeping President Donald J. Trump in office against the will of Arizona voters, and depriving Arizona voters of their right to vote and have their votes counted. The names of the 7 Trump allies are redacted from the indictment, meaning they have not yet been served notice of the charges against them. Though their names are redacted, as are the specific charges against them, details in the indictment made clear that the architects of Trump's national campaign to steal the election are also facing charges in Arizona. Those individuals appear to include Trump lawyer Rudy Giuliani and John Eastman, former Chief of Staff Mark Meadows, lawyers Jenna Ellis and Christina Bobb, and Trump advisors Boris Epstein and Michael Roman. Trump himself is, according to the document, indicted co-conspirator number 1. The Arizonans now facing charges include powerful and influential GOP figures, a former Republican Party of Arizona chairman, a Republican National Committee man and executive at Turning Point USA and its political arm, and two sitting state senators, one of whom retains immense political power at the Arizona Capitol. The grand jury's decision could levy criminal consequences for an unprecedented plot to subvert the will of Arizona voters, one that has ruptured faith in elections and fueled election conspiracies that have taken root in GOP politics in the state. It comes as Mays has promised to aggressively combat election conspiracies, offering a sharp contrast to her predecessor. Mays reflected the gravity of the case in a 5-minute video statement released Wednesday. Mays said, "Whatever their reasoning was, the plot to violate the law must be answered for, and I was elected to uphold the law of this state. The scheme, had it succeeded, would have deprived Arizona's voters of their right to have their votes counted for their chosen president. It effectively would have made their right to vote meaningless," Mays said. The grand jury, a panel of Arizonans who met in secret in recent weeks, heard evidence presented by Mays prosecutors and ultimately decided there was enough to substantiate criminal charges. The 11 electors are each charged with 9 criminal counts, including conspiracy, fraudulent schemes and artifices, fraudulent schemes and practices, and 6 counts of forgery. Many of the electors or their attorneys could not be reached by the Arizona Republic late Wednesday to comment on the indictment. Hoffman revived his previous statements, claiming May's investigation weaponized the once respected office. Hoffman said in the statement, "Let me be unequivocal. I am innocent of any crime. I will vigorously defend myself, and I look forward to the day when I am vindicated of this naked political persecution by the judicial process." The statement directs reporters to contact Dillon Law Group, the namesake firm of Harmeet Dillon that has represented Trump and his aides in other states, for more information. Lamon's lawyer, Dennis Willinchuk, said his client will be acquitted and they look forward to suing May's office for damages over the accusations. Willinchuk said, "It's a politically motivated prosecution. I can see no crime in any of it." Willinchuk also represents one of 2 Republican Cochise County supervisors who are facing criminal charges brought by May's office in another case. He has said that case, too, was motivated by political partisanship. Mays has been under immense political pressure to bring a case. Similar slates of electors in Michigan, Georgia, and Nevada have already been charged for their role in the sweeping effort to keep Trump in power. And a federal grand jury last year brought charges against Trump himself, alleging the former president conspired with others to disenfranchise voters and subvert Biden's win. Trump is also facing charges in the Georgia case, which alleges he led a criminal enterprise and relies on a state law normally reserved for prosecuting mobsters. Several of the Arizona electors have previously claimed they were merely offering Congress a backup plan, though nothing in the documents they sent to Congress and the National Archives backs up that assertion. Similar groups of electors in other states did include conditional language, but none was included in Arizona. Biden carried Arizona in November 2020 by a 10,457 vote margin with nearly 3.4 million votes cast. It was Biden's smallest margin of victory in any state, and only the second time in 70 years that a Democrat won the state. Arizona actually had 2 different groups of illegitimate GOP electors. The indictment made public on Wednesday names the slate that included more prominent Republican figures, and some of whose involvement has already been well established by the Congressional Committee investigating the violent break-in at the U.S. Capitol on January 6 of 2021. Those 11 GOP electors met at the Arizona Republican headquarters in Phoenix on December 4, 2020, posting videos on social media of themselves casting their votes for Trump. They signed paperwork to submit to Congress claiming they were, quote, duly elected and qualified, end quote, electors, but that was a lie. The same day, electors for Biden met to cast their votes in the Electoral College, confirming the Democrats' win. They met at an undisclosed location, citing security concerns tied to Trump's refusal to accept his loss. It was a procedural process that prior to 2020 was a formality often overlooked by most Americans.
And here from USA Today, takeaways from the historic Supreme Court case arguments in the Trump immunity case. Dateline Washington. The Supreme Court appeared inclined yesterday to reject former President Donald Trump's historic claim that he's totally immune from prosecution, but the justices could still limit the charges he faces and delay his trial on election interference charges. The justices could decide that the lower courts need to investigate whether immunity applies to any of Trump's actions before he can be tried. That would likely make it impossible for a trial to be finished before voters decide in November whether to return Trump to the White House. John Yoo, a former Justice Department official under George W. Bush, said, "Trump had much more success than many court watchers expected. Only the three liberal justices seemed to reject the idea of immunity outright." If Trump becomes president, he could order the Justice Department to dismiss the charges against him. Here are some of the takeaways from the court's more than 2.5 hours of debate. It was a conservative justice and one of Trump's three nominees on the court who looked for ways for Trump's trial to proceed. Justice Amy Coney Barrett first got Trump's attorney to agree that there's no immunity for a president's private actions, as opposed to those taken in official capacity as president. Reading from the indictment, Barrett then asked John Sauer, Trump's attorney, if some of the charges against Trump involved only private conduct. What about conspiring with a private attorney to file false allegations, or to using another attorney to spread claims about election fraud that he knew were false? She asked. Sauer disputed the characterization of those allegations, but said that if true, they cover private actions. When it was the Justice Department's turn at the bench, Barrett asked attorney Michael Dreeben about the possibility of the special counsel trying Trump just on the charges that undisputably include only private actions. She said, "The special counsel has expressed some concern for speed and wanting to move forward. Is there another option for the special counsel to just proceed based on the private conduct and drop the official conduct?" Dreeben said the two are interrelated because the steps Trump took as president made his other actions more likely to succeed. He said, "We would like to present that as an integrated picture to the jury so that it sees the sequence and the gravity of the conduct and why each step occurred." Since even Trump's attorney agreed that the former president is not immune from prosecution from some of the charges, the big question is whether the Supreme Court will direct the lower court to take additional action before seating a jury. That will determine whether a trial can begin before the November election. Chief Justice John Roberts asked Trump's attorney what should happen if the Supreme Court latches onto his concession that private acts can be prosecuted. That attorney, Sauer, said the district court should have to determine which charges meet the definition before Trump can be tried. Justice Sonia Sotomayor backed the Justice Department's position that the district court judge can decide those issues as the trial unfolds. Sotomayor told Sawyer, "So I'm not sure that I understand why your problems couldn't be taken care of at trial with an instruction. If we believe, and if the court were to find, I'm not even sure how they could, but if it were to find that some public acts could not be the basis of criminal liability." Rick Hassan, an election law expert at the UCLA School of Law, predicts the court's decision will be closer to the government's position than it will be to Trump's sweeping immunity argument. But the justices are likely to find different ways of getting there, he said, which means the opinion will take longer to write and a majority will want further proceedings. Hassan said, "The bottom line is that Trump is likely to get what he wants, a further delay of this election subversion case, maybe pushing it to after the election."
Anti-war protests spread to more campuses. This story by John Bacon, Eduardo Cuevas, and Jorge L. Ortiz from USA Today. protesters at Columbia University in New York, an epicenter of growing student dissent against the war in Gaza, face a deadline to dismantle their encampment after police arrested demonstrators at universities in Georgia, Massachusetts, Texas, and California. At Columbia, scene of more than 100 arrests in recent days, school president Mayush Shafiq warned students that if the tents are not moved by Friday, we will have to consider alternative options for clearing the campus and restoring calm to campus. House Speaker Mike Johnson, Republican of Louisiana, lashed out Thursday at Columbia protesters who booed him during his visit to the school a day earlier. Johnson had criticized students and faculty who participated in the protest and called for Shafiq's resignation. Johnson said in a social media post referring to posts Wednesday by Palestinian militant group Hamas and Iran's supreme leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, praising the anti-Gaza war protest on U.S. college campuses, Hamas backed these protests at Columbia. The things that happened at the hands of Hamas are horrific, and yet these protesters are out there waving flags for the very people who committed those crimes. This is not who we are in America, Johnson said. Activist and frequent presidential candidate Jill Stein visited the encampment Thursday. A few feet from the ongoing protest, mechanical engineer student Nate Tursky was on campus for the first time in days. Tursky, who was planting small Israeli flags, said he had feared he would face anti-Semitic language and threats. The last time he helped place Israeli flags there, soon after October 7, they were taken down, he said. We hope that doesn't happen again, but I am not confident. Columbia's Board of Trustees on Thursday threw its weight behind Shafiq, the former president of the London School of Economics, who, in her first year on the job, is steering Columbia through its most tumultuous school year since the Vietnam era. The board wrote in a public announcement, "During the search process for this role, President Shafiq told us she would always take a thoughtful approach to resolving conflict, balancing the disparate voices that make up a vibrant campus like Columbia's, while taking a firm stance against hatred, harassment, and discrimination. That is exactly what she is doing now." The support came a day before the school's main governing body, the University Senate, could vote on a resolution to formally censure her over her decision to call police to the Manhattan campus last week. The resolution, obtained by USA Today, accuses Shafiq of a violation of the fundamental requirements of academic freedom and shared governance and an unprecedented assault on student rights. The motion does not call for her resignation. Some faculty leaders think Shafiq's department would hand a win to politicians who have, in their way, improperly interfered in campus affairs. At Emory University in Atlanta, the Emory Wheel reported officers from the Emory Police Department, Atlanta Police Department, and Georgia State Patrol began using gas and arresting protesters on Thursday morning, a few hours after protesters set up tents in the school's quadrangle. University President Gregory Fennis said most of the protesters were not associated with the university. In Boston, Emerson College President Jay Bernhardt canceled classes Thursday as we respond to and process the events of last night. Police spokesperson Michael Torrigan said 108 arrests were made and four officers injured late Wednesday when police took down an encampment. Emerson Students for Justice in Palestine was encouraging protesters to rally at police precincts across the city. About 70 students from Washington, D.C. area universities, including Georgetown and the George Washington Universities, formed an encampment of 25 tents on George Washington campus early Thursday morning. They are protesting their school's investment of funds in companies doing business with Israel, the Georgetown Voice reported. Also, students at Northwestern University, just north of Chicago, set up tents. At Princeton University, two graduate students were arrested for trespassing, and tents were taken down Thursday. At UCLA, Students for Justice in Palestine set up an encampment Thursday. "We are not leaving till our demands are met," the group said. At the University of Texas in Austin, the Palestine Solidarity Committee posted a call to stand with the arrested, stand with Gaza. And a student coalition at Michigan State set up a Gaza solitary encampment Thursday. Students from the coalition have attended every Board of Trustees meeting since October. And MSU President Kevin Gukasweta said, "I don't want to be known as a place that has shut down free speech or one's ability to express themselves," he said. "College campuses have been the epicenter for activism and protest for decades."
And for the last 90 minutes, your readers have been Judith Linden and Dave Buzik. It's been our pleasure to read for you. Thanks for putting up with the tail end of our viruses here. We'll take a short break to allow our next readers to get in place. We hope you have a great weekend.
Welcome back to the reading of the Des Moines Register and USA Today. Your new readers are Jim Hoffman, and my name is Rachel Thorson Mithelman. We'll continue now with the opinion page from USA Today, and here is Jim with our first article.
Thank you, Rachel, and we're here starting off with the opinion page from USA Today. And I'm going to share with you an article written by Sarah Pequeno. And she is a columnist for USA Today. "I found a love for women's sports because of Caitlin Clark. I would never call myself a sports person, and I'm not athletically gifted. I'm too short, too bow-legged, and too awkward. I don't get excited about the Olympics and spent my college years at the University of North Carolina missing basketball games by working instead. I hear they have a good team. Recently, however, my attitude toward sports has changed. Like most good things in my life, that's thanks to women. I'm one of the casual fans who has been swept up in the frenzy over women's basketball, fed in part by Caitlin Clark's ascent to household name. I'm also from the South and felt it was my duty to cheer on the University of South Carolina Lady Gamecocks when my friends and I squeezed into a Brooklyn one-bedroom to watch them win the Women's Basketball National Championship this month. I couldn't tell you the most interesting plays of the game, but I could tell you what I felt watching as South Carolina coach Dawn Staley broke down on camera, surrounded by the team that helped her get a third national title as head coach after an undefeated season. It was the feeling I had been waiting for, the feeling that keeps sports in our collective conscience and keeps fans coming back year after year. This feeling, I think it's called being a fan, has continued into the month as I've watched respective moments from both Clark and Staley. I watched Clark take on Saturday Night Live's Weekend Update host Michael Che for his misogynist jokes at the expense of women athletes, where she took time to uplift other basketball players who paved the way, including the Gamecocks coach. I heard Staley praise Clark, now an Indiana Fever player, for elevating the game and growing viewership numbers. It's actions like that, to me, that makes this moment so special. There's a reason why tickets to the women's Final Four games cost more than the men's side. There's a reason that viewership for the women's basketball championship surpassed the men's final with 18.9 million viewers to their 14.8 million. There's a reason you can't go online without seeing Clark's face or hearing mention of the WNBA draft, whose 2023 season also saw a spike in viewership. The reason is Clark, but it doesn't change the fact that the entire sport should have been getting more recognition for years. The fact that women's sports have been treated as secondary to the men's teams for so long is thanks to generations of misogyny. It shouldn't take an uncomfortable comment from a sports journalist or a player opening up about their working conditions for the rest of their working conditions for the rest of us to realize that women still aren't receiving the respect they deserve. This lack of support affects game attendance, which in turn affects the working conditions of the players. It's why the United States women's national soccer team had to go to court to earn annual salaries comparable to their male counterparts, despite winning 4 World Cups and 4 Olympic gold medals. It's why WNBA players have spoken up about the conditions they travel and play under. And it's why Clark, arguably the most talked about basketball player of the past 2 years, is starting in the league making a fraction of what the first pick in the men's draft will receive in their first contracts. It is not fair that female professionals in their field are not being paid comparably to men. It shouldn't matter that it's occurring outside of what we consider a typical profession. We might be experiencing another spike in popularity before the frenzy dies down. Every few seasons, it'll feel like we've made strides in popularizing the wildly inoffensive idea that women's sports deserve the same enthusiasm and fair pay for that enthusiasm the men receive only for reporters and advertisers to move on after the season ends. We've seen it before with the 2019 Women's World Cup. Women's sports don't have to be a niche community. I'm happy to be here and want others to hop on the bandwagon. These games can be for everyone. They just need the support of the sports media landscape and the advertisers. We've already seen how this can create household names. We only have to look to athletes like Simone Biles, Serena Williams, and Megan Rapinoe. All of them have name recognition because they are both phenomenal players and have become fixtures on our screens thanks to advertising. For me, I hope to keep the momentum going by catching some New York Liberty games in the upcoming season. I hope you look into tickets for your local WNBA team as well. We could all stand to put our money where our mouths are and keep feeding the excitement around women's sports. Everyone deserves to be able to watch a team they care about with people they care about. I've realized it's good for the soul, regardless of what gender is wearing the jerseys.
The second piece on the USA Today opinion page is by columnist Ingrid Jacques. She is a USA Today columnist, and it's titled USC, USC Fails Valedictorians' Free Speech Rights. It's accompanied by a photograph of USC students protesting last week the cancellation of the speech by the valedictorian Asa Nabasam. Things are not well on America's college campuses. The disgusting antisemitism that seems only to be building and campus administrators' lackluster response has led to some truly frightening displays. Violence and rule-breaking behavior must not be tolerated, period. Yet higher education leaders cannot make an unsettling time an excuse to censor perfectly fine speech just because they fear a difficult situation. That's what happened at the University of Southern California when the Los Angeles school decided last week to cancel valedictorian Asa Nabasam's commencement speech in May, the first time that USC has prevented its top graduate from speaking at the graduation ceremony. College officials claimed they were concerned about the alarming tenor that had taken place on social media after Tabassum was named valedictorian. The ongoing Israel-Hamas war in Gaza has led to increased tensions in the United States following Hamas's brutal attack against Israel on October 7th. Detractors were displeased about Tabassum's support of Palestinians and accused her of, quote, anti-Semitic and anti-Zionist rhetoric, end quote. According to Provost Andrew Guzman, he said in a statement on April 15th, the intensity of feelings fueled by both social media and the ongoing conflict in the Middle East has grown to include many voices outside of USC and has escalated to the point of creating substantial risks relating to security and disruption at commencement. This decision is not only necessary to maintain the safety of our campus and students, but is consistent with the fundamental legal obligation. Following controversy over the decision to prevent Tabassum from speaking, USC has since doubled down by canceling appearances of other speakers and honorees. Not only is USC's decision an affront to free speech, it's also fundamentally unfair to Tabassum, who undoubtedly worked hard in her years at the university to earn this achievement. She shouldn't have this experience taken from her. In a statement, Tabassum said she is surprised that USC, quote, abandoned her. Now Tabassum may well have repugnant personal views, and her speech may stoke division on campus. Even so, her accomplishment should not be undermined because of fears of possible violence in a speech she likely hadn't even written yet. Rather, the university should have committed to keeping her and others attending graduation safe, And if it knew of a tangible security threat, it should be upfront about that. The Foundation for Individual Rights and Expression faults USC for how it handled this situation. While USC is a private university, it commits to First Amendment-like free speech. And the Foundation for Individual Rights and Expression, known as FIRE, points to how California law requires private, secular colleges and universities to give students the same speech rights they'd have at the state's public institutions. In their statement, FIRE said, implicit in the idea of a campus committed to robust, expressive rights is that administrators won't censor their students just because they have controversial views. Meanwhile, administrators at private Adrian College in Michigan are handling their own controversy in much better fashion. They're pretty much ignoring it. Last month, Adrian College announced that Riley Gaines would be its commencement speaker on May 5th. Gaines, who is often described in the media as an anti-trans rights activist, is a lot more than that. She is an accomplished former NCAA competitive swimmer who became well known after she tied transgender swimmer Leah Thomas in the 200-yard NCAA freestyle championship race in 2022. Following that experience, Gaines has become an outspoken defender of fairness in women's sports and speaks frequently on the issue at universities around the country. Gaines is used to attracting pushback and even violence on campuses, so it's probably no surprise to her that there are factions of the Adrian community who aren't happy that she will speak at the school. A student LGBTQ plus group started an online petition urging the college to disinvite Gaines. It now has more than 1,600 signatures. But the college isn't backing down. The president, Jeffrey Docking, said in a news release last month, Adrian College has never shied away from presenting and debating substantive disagreements on campus. In fact, this is precisely the purpose of universities, to engage in civil discourse of controversial issues. We welcome Riley Gaines to our beautiful campus, and we feel confident our students will be inspired by her commencement address. I hope Docking and fellow administrators stay firm in their commitment. And even though it may be embarrassing for USC to backtrack, it should reinstate valedictorian Tabassum as a speaker at commencement. More than ever, college students need examples of what free expression really looks like.
Thank you, Rachel. And we turn to the sports page. And we have sports on TV today. There's quite a selection for you. In the National Hockey League, we have at 6 p.m. on TNT, True TV, and we have New York Rangers at Washington. At 6:30 on TBS, Vancouver's at Nashville. At 9 p.m. on TNT and True, Winnipeg at Colorado. And at 9:30, we have TBS Edmonton at the L.A. Kings. National Basketball Association, we've got several games. 4:30 on ESPN, Milwaukee's at Indiana. At 7 on ESPN, we have the L.A. Clippers at Dallas. 9:30 on ESPN, Minnesota at Phoenix. And then baseball, there's a full slate of games on at 12:10 this afternoon. Major League Baseball Network, Kansas City's at Detroit. And at 6:10, Apple TV Plus, St. Louis, the Cardinals at the Mets. At 6:40, Apple TV Plus, Tampa Bay at Chicago White Sox. At 7:05 on Major League Baseball Network, Cincinnati's at Texas. At 7:10, Major League Baseball Network, we have Yankees at Milwaukee. And then at 8:40, we have a couple of games. Major League Baseball Network, Philadelphia Phillies at San Diego, and Arizona on ESPN Plus against Seattle. We have the Register's newest athletes of the week chosen. This written by Joe Randleman of the Des Moines Register. Olwine girls golfer Grace Lewis and Cedar Rapids Prairie boys tennis player Anthony Schulte were voted the Des Moines Register's Iowa Ortho female and male athletes of the week for the week of April 15th to 21st. Lewis won Female Athlete of the Week with 55% of the vote. Waukee Northwest girls tennis player Riley Hilton was a close second with 44%. Lewis tied for the lowest 18-hole score in the state during a meet at Prairie Links Golf Club in Waverly on April 15th. Lewis shot a 2-under par score of 70. She won the meet by 4 strokes to help Olwine cruise to the team win with a score of 330. Schulte easily won the Male Athlete of the Week vote with 84% of the vote. Beckman Catholic boys golfer Luke Harwick placed second with 8%. Schulte knocked off Lynn Mars' Malcolm Rice in the number one singles match during Prairie's 7-2 loss to the Lions on Friday in Cedar Rapids. Schulte swept Rice by scores of 6-0 and 6-4.
We have a few minutes before we turn to Dear Abby, so this relatively brief story from Iowa State football. Iowa State football on Wednesday announced that it will play abroad for the first time in program history. The Cyclones will open their 2025 season against Kansas State in the Aer Lingus College Football Classic on August 23, 2025, at Aviva Stadium in Dublin, Ireland. We are extremely grateful for this opportunity presented to us by Aer Lingus to provide the young men in our football program an unrivaled educational, cultural, and athletic experience, Iowa State Director of Athletics Jamie Pollard said in a press release. He went on, Iowa State fans enjoy a tremendous reputation for following the Cyclones wherever they play, and we look forward to seeing them travel with us to the Emerald Isle for the 2025 season opener. This event will take place on week zero of the 2025 college football schedule and mark the sixth college football game ever played at Dublin's 48,000-seat Aviva Stadium. It is the first Big 12 conference matchup in Ireland and will be the first season-opening meeting between ISU and K-State, according to the release. Matt Campbell said in a news release, this is a tremendous opportunity for the Big 12 Conference to play one of its classic rivalries on a global stage while showcasing our university and its football program. We are honored that Aer Lingus selected the Cyclones to participate in this prestigious game, which will afford a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity for our student-athletes to experience international travel while also helping to grow the game of college football outside of the U.S. The Aer Lingus College Football Classic aims to bring American college football to Ireland annually to promote Ireland as a travel destination. In 2025 will be the fourth consecutive season that college football begins its season with a game in Dublin, the release said. The jumping ahead just a bit, since Aviva Stadium opened in 2010, previous college football games played there include a pair of Notre Dame versus Navy games, a Georgia Tech versus Boston College game, and Nebraska versus Northwestern. I welcome the news that Kansas State University and Iowa State University have been chosen to play the fourth match in the Aer Lingus College Football Classic Series, Ireland's Minister for Tourism, Catherine Martin, said in the release. This event is now a firm fixture in the Irish sporting calendar and provides a huge boost to tourism and hospitality in Ireland. and creates a great atmosphere in Dublin for visitors and locals alike. So that sounds like great fun. It's time to turn to Dear Abby for today. There are two letters, so we'll each read one. Dear Abby, my boyfriend is 18 years younger than I am. Our relationship hasn't been perfect, but I love him to death. Unfortunately, I'm going through menopause and have all the side effects. Long story short, he found another girl. It was just supposed to be for sex, and he told me he wouldn't get into another relationship or marry anyone but me. Well, he fell for her, which I warned him he was going to do. They are both at my apartment. I'm trying to make him happy by allowing this, but he can be so mean to me, and he's so nice to her. He tells me how nice she is, etc. I told him it's because he hasn't hurt her yet. He won't have sex with me now. He claims he isn't favoring her, but he is. I love him so much and don't want to lose him. I'm in so much pain because I can't please him in every way. I don't know what to do. Should I allow this and try to make it work, or should I give up, since it seems like he has given up on me? Signed, Can't Stop Crying. Abby says, Dear Can't Stop, let me get this straight. Your much younger boyfriend and his new girlfriend live in your apartment rent-free, and he no longer makes love with you. What are you getting out of this charade besides pain? If I thought it would help, I'd advise you to stick it out and hope his romance will blow over, but I can't, because whatever respect and gratitude he felt for you is gone. The pain you are experiencing will end only when you find your self-respect and usher the two lovebirds out the door. For your own sake, please do it soon.
And our second letter, Dear Abby, I am super outgoing. Always have been. I can walk up to anyone and start a conversation. As I've gotten older, I've noticed that many people have no personality. During the pandemic, it became exponentially worse. Neighbors don't speak. People look at their phones every waking minute, and have lost their conversational skills. It is pathetic. I'm smart, but I'm not telepathic. If people don't know how to simply say hi or good morning, something is wrong. COVID shut things down. But if you weren't friendly before the pandemic, how are you going to be 5 years from now? Humanity is doomed if we don't interact. Signed, Friendly in the East. And Abby writes, Dear Friendly, the COVID disruption may have contributed to what you are describing, but it had been building for at least the past 20 years. As people became more and more fixated on their electronic devices, the ability to look someone in the eye and converse withered. If you don't look someone in the eye and communicate in person, the ability to read social cues withers and is eventually lost. I believe this has caused much of the isolation and loneliness we are experiencing in our society. If we are going to fix this, people will have to teach themselves to unplug and reach out to the people around them. Making the time to exchange social amenities as simple as smiling and saying good morning is an easy place to start.
And that brings us to the end of the Des Moines Register for today, Friday, April 26th. My name is Rachel Mithelman, and my partner at the microphone has been Jim Hoffman. Earlier, you heard Dave Busick and Judith Linden. You can listen to IRIS programs on any computer or smart device at any time at iowaradioreading.org. And support for today's readings comes from the Des Moines Register, Iowa Public Radio, Iowa PBS, and bensoundmusic.com. Thank you for listening to IRIS, Iowa's first and only radio reading service.